Well, I'm always very eager to come back to Glen Eyrie and share with you some of the things that the Lord does from time to time as we have a chance to travel around and serve in one way or another. And of course, the reason I'm eager to get back here is because I know that some of you really do bear down in prayer for those of us that that travel, and we really appreciate that. And I know that many of you prayed for me, especially on this trip, because of some of the unusual aspects of it. And I just want to come back and thank you and tell you a little bit about what the Lord did during these, we left in early July and got back a couple days ago. So it was a long trip, but very fruitful, I felt. The Lord really, really blessed. And I know I saw in the Glen Eyrie bulletin, that little mimeographed sheet that goes out, that we're praying now for George and Jack and Jim Peterson as they travel. But I'd like to add Jerry White's name to that. I didn't see Jerry's name on that list. Maybe it was on 1 week before or something. But anyhow, this is Jerry's first time alone, traveling alone out in the Pacific, going to all these military bases and all. So it's going to be a new world for him out there. So if you, as the Lord brings it to mind, I know he'd appreciate your prayers. Let me just start out by telling you the first place I went and just kind of go through it. I arrived in Europe all fired up. Because from Denver to Kennedy Air Force Base, wherever that place is, New York City, had a chance to witness to a college professor the whole way. I mean, we sat down and we started out, and it went very, very well the whole way. And had a chance to give word of testimony, preach the gospel, give the bridge, you name it, give other people's testimonies, you know. This person was really excited about, because, of course, working with young people, and not really understanding that these this sort of thing is going on in the young lives of people that you know he was acquainted with. But anyhow, I got off the plane all excited. Well, then I got on the 747 out of Kennedy to go to Madrid, and I sat down next to a young guy. Discovered he was a skating star from Norway who travels the world with like Holiday on Ice and ice capades and all like this. He had won every prize there was in Norway. He went through all the intricate stuff they have to learn and explained all ice skating rules and everything. And we went on and on and on. And then finally, you know, what do you do? So then we got into it. And from then on, it was all over. You know, he just sat there and listened. And he had, you know, the world had become pretty jaded to him by this time. He had seen everything, done everything, been everywhere, made lots of money, and realized that there was just nothing in it. So from then on, I had a great time witnessing to this guy. And he had to land and catch another plane and go right to work that night, and flew in to Kennedy from Rio de Janeiro, where he'd been skating down there. And it was one long trip and get off the plane and skate some more, you know. So he was a little disenchanted. So, but anyhow, I felt the Lord gave us a great time. He wasn't ready to receive the Lord, but very close. And I've been praying for him. And then when I arrived in Madrid, I met by Jack Blanche. And, of course, I was all excited. And had a chance while I was in town for 3 days just to turn my clock around and see some of the city. Jack took me out to the university. Had a chance to have lunch or dinner with Jerry and Carol and Doug and Betty and Jack and Joanne. One interesting thing about the university there is that there's bars on all the windows and the doors. Heavy iron bars on all the windows and all the doors. And this is not to keep people out, but to keep people in. And the way this works, if there's any sort of a riot or somebody burns a cop car or raises a banner saying, you know, down with the government or something, all the doors go shut, all the windows go shut, and everybody's in jail. They got the whole school in jail. And there they sit in jail until they, you know, put out the fire or tear down the banner or put this, you know, shoot this guy or something. And it turns into one huge jail. Well, it's interesting, you know, living in a country where, you know, under a dictatorship. I mean, they just turned universities into jails, and that's the way they handle it. It's efficient, but, you know, you wouldn't recommend it necessarily. Well, after getting my clock turned around there and having a great time with his staff and had a chance to preach to them all one day for a couple hours, in fact, about 2 hours and a half we sat and shared the word with them, then I got on the plane and went to Luzon. And this was an unusual time. I had been a little apprehensive about the whole thing because of reports that I'd gotten from other conferences like this. I'd heard people talk, you know, and I thought, well, nuts, another conference. But it really wasn't another conference. It was really something special, at least for me. And for many others, I guess, as I've talked to them after having gotten back and while we were there. But let me tell you a little bit about what the Lord did for some of the navigators that attended. Gene Carson was the one whom God chose to be the chairwoman for all the women's meetings. That means every time the women got together, and they got together frequently, Gene Carson was the one who ran those meetings. Well, that was exciting, of course, to have Gene in such a terrific spot because she became well known with many of the women leaders of the world. But not only that, we'd have meetings every day. After the final meeting, before supper, we'd have about a 30-minute session where we'd all huddle in chairs, all the nav gang that was there, and we'd give reports. Well, Gene would come all excited because this day, buddy from Germany wanted to translate her book into German and publish it in Germany. And then the next day, you know, Gene wrote a book, something about the women of the Bible. So the Germans wanted to translate it. Well, then the next day, the French. She met some, just happened to sit next to somebody, you know, one of the French, and they wanted to translate it. Then somebody from Japan wanted to translate it. Then the Chinese wanted to translate it. Then somebody from the English wanted to translate it. And while Gene was there, she met, I mean, God would just put her into, you know, lunch or something with somebody that was a key person in this field, and they begin to talk and ask about, you know, and pretty soon the book would be brought up, and there it would be. And Gene would show up at these meetings, you know, all excited about what the Lord was doing and how excited she was, and then some of the things about the women's meetings. But God used Gene and also opened the door, I think, for her ministry. Scotty, as you know, the film strip, The Task Before Us, was shown at the first meeting. Have they had a report on that? Has anyone given a report on this film strip?
They saw the film strip.
You've seen the film strip. Okay, well then you know the impact that it has. Well, it had the same kind of impact on the people over there. Everybody that I talked to was higher than a kite about that thing that Scotty put together. And you'd be walking down the hall with Scotty, you know, and somebody would stop and say, "You're Waldron Scott. Can we use that film strip here? And, you know, every mission group, every church, it seemed that, you know, saw the thing, wanted to get a hold of that thing and use it. And then Scotty would come to the meetings. He'd have a little handful of slips of paper from his box, saying, "Dear Mr. Scott, we saw the film strip. Can we use it in our thing?" So here again, you see, the Lord greatly used Scotty's efforts and the efforts of some of you here. I know you worked pretty hard to get that out, and it was really used of God. It made a remarkable hit. Ford Madison, who was led to a businessman in Wichita, Kansas, who used to run a business here in Colorado Springs, Ford Madison was one of four businessmen chosen worldwide. There were a couple from the Orient, one I think from Africa, and one from America. And Ford was the one that was chosen from America. Ford was led to Christ by Hugh Harris, I think, and followed up by Doug Sparks while he was here in the city. And is a pretty checked out navigator and, you know, good troop. And Ford and I roomed together for the last week or so of the conference there. But he was chosen to be on a panel. Well, this panel really sort of brought the conference alive at one point in the thing. It had a real impact, especially Ford's presentation. And I don't think I could overstate the impact that Ford's presentation had on this Luzon conference. Here again, I'd be walking, because we were rooming together, we'd show up at the place together and leave together, and we'd see each other through the day. And to be walking along and someone say, "You're Ford Madison." "Yeah." "Oh, listen, can you come to our..." And then there'd be a need, you see, a need for trained laymen. And this was a constant thing with Ford. And we'd go into the meeting, and before he'd get a chance to sit down, somebody would run across the aisle and grab him and talk to him about coming and helping here and helping there. And I think this is one of the things that I saw showing up at this particular conference, was the awareness of the need for trained laymen to do their thing. And the more I sat and listened to all that, the more I realized how God has prepared us in a rather unusual way down through the years to be of tremendous service in this one field. If we would just, you know, somehow figure out a way to put our finger on that. There's a worldwide need, a real crying need for laymen who know what to do and help other laymen. My time, of course, was spent mostly as a learner, since this was my first times at a conference like this. I arrived, and because I had been asked to take that workshop, well, I was given a speaker's badge and told to go to a speaker's meeting, which was a little unnerving for me, by the way, because, you know, here I am, and you all know me. So I sat in this speaker's meeting. Well, here sat Billy Graham. Here sat, you know, Leighton Ford. Here was Paul Little. Down here was Bill Bright. around me were all these guys, and here I'm sitting there, you know, what do I do now? You know, bite my fingernails or what? But in that meeting, when it was over, and a British clergyman spoke to us all and told us about our responsibilities and how, you know, the Lord would be counting on us during these days. Then, and after howdying with some people that I knew, Paul Little came up. And he said, you ready to hang in? Well, I wasn't quite sure what hang in meant, you know, but I'd written to him offering my services to do anything that he'd like to have me do. So I said, yeah, you know, I'm ready to hang in. What do you need? And Lauren had told me, you know, make sure you go to Paul and tell him you're ready to, you know, empty waste baskets, move chairs, throw unruly people out of meetings, whatever they need done, just you're there to do it, see? So I thought, great. So I told him that. And he said, well, he said, I got a project that needs done. The national strategy groups will meet every day for about an hour and a half. These are when the nations get together every day for an hour and a half to decide among themselves what is the best way to reach their nation for Christ. And these people will write a report every day on what they came up with in that meeting. What I want you to do is summarize each of those reports and turn it into me as a summary. Well, it was quite interesting. And whenever you'd have a grouping of nations, like French-speaking Africa or the Caribbeans, they'd put those in one group or in one room. And the first day, like in some of these groups, all we'd get back was, there's too many of us in this room. We can't work together. There's too many of us. Then the second day was, we'll try it one more day, but we don't think this is a good idea. Then the third day was, boy, it's really great to get to know each other. We're really enjoying each other's fellowship. What a blessing it is to be together. And then the fourth day, you know, we're having a blessed time. God is blessing our time together. And by the end of that conference, the Lord had knit hearts in these various regions of the world in such a way that they had never been knit before. I mean, I know that from their actions to each other the first two or three days. Now, one of the keys to world evangelization is the unity of believers, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And this conference, if nothing else, was used to unite people of this, you know, in this way, really knit together in heart, not just signing a covenant, which many of us did at the end of the conference, but in these small groups, seeing these people really get their hearts together. And I felt the reason that I was given that particular job, by the way, then the last day, each of them turned in their final plans. Each nation turned in its final plan for the evangelization of that nation. And these would be 5 and 6 pages, 10 pages, maybe, you know, a thick. And I was asked to go read every one of those and then write trends that I thought showed up in all those papers and then turn those into Paul. Well, I told Lauren this earlier this year. One of the things I've been praying about was an opportunity to learn something about the mission field. I feel I know so little about, you know, the mission field and the world and its real needs. And I'd been a little disgruntled, as a matter of fact, before I left, because I had gotten busy in two or three things and was not able to set aside time. 2 years ago, my special study was disciple-making, how to develop disciple-makers. And we went to Squaw Valley and talked about that, and that came out of that. Then last year, my special study was witnessing, and then this book came out of that. Well, this year, I felt I've been robbed, I've been cheated. I'll get back, the summer will be gone, and I will not have accomplished my objective. Well, the last day of this conference, I sat from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m., reading the national strategies of every nation represented. I think there were I can't remember how many nations. I probably have that down maybe somewhere. But anyhow, all these nations. And I really got the feel of it. It was I felt, you know, a real answer to prayer. All these final summaries. And I looked every one of them over and I read every word, except I didn't get a chance to read the Eastern European countries. I read them daily, but not the final summary, which was a little discouraging, really. I had it in my hand and I was just ready to read it. And some secretary came in and said, Leroy, where's the one for Eastern Europe? Have you seen it? And I said, yeah, I got it right here. She said, they want to redo it. So I gave it to her because the stuff that they had put in, they felt had been too much and was just a little too much was stated in these reports. So they wanted to redo them. And that way I didn't get a chance to read those. But anyhow, the others I did get a chance. And let me just, on that, read to you. Oh, then I came across one. You know, they're all, you know, 8, 10 pages, half dozen pages, typewritten. Then I came across one, very short, laying with one little piece of paper, from a group of people who just a few years ago were headhunters and cannibals. And this was their national strategy. Now, I can't tell you what it was, because I don't feel that would be right, because I was given this as kind of a side job. But let me read you what they said. National strategy. We have always known the need for a supernatural authority and control of life and destiny. The gods of our fathers provided a system of spiritual authority. We feared these gods, found no reason to love and respect them. The preaching of the gospel has shown us how great was our darkness. As those who have been delivered from idols to serve the living and true God, we are convinced there's only one meaningful authority in life, Jesus. We know from our experience there's only one true guide in life, His Word, the Bible. Humbly, yet willingly and joyfully, we do place ourselves under the sole authority of Christ and His Holy Word. Well, I was really touched by that. And then I thought to myself, you know, there's a national strategy. If I have ever read a national strategy, there is a national strategy. To humbly, yet willingly and joyfully, place ourselves under the sole authority of Christ and His Holy Word. Now, I don't know how that strikes you, but that strikes me as quite a statement from some people that have only known the Lord for just a few years, you know. The workshop that I was given went far better than I had ever dreamed it would. The first three times we were packed out, and people would come and they would see all the chairs gone and people hunched up in, and so they would leave, and then we'd hope to come back the next day. By the fourth day, there were so much high-powered preaching, so much workshop, so much everything, that people began to get a little full, you know. So my fourth day, there was, I guess, maybe three or four chairs, maybe half a dozen chairs empty. But all the rest of the time, the place was full, and the response was just great. And I sent home a special note through Judy that I wanted the people in shipping and the printing and the art department to get a special word of thanks from me for that work they did. Because the materials that I took, the little presentation that I had on the overhead, they really captivated that crowd. And God just blessed in a wonderful way. And Aldo, Paul Yu, Gert Dornenbaal, and Cito, each of these guys took some time in my workshop to tell, it was a workshop, by the way, on a program for personal follow-up, told how follow-up had been accomplished in their own lives, and then what they were doing in their nations to follow up others. So this added an international flavor to it, you know, and a little realism, and this is what we're doing over in Korea or Brazil or wherever. So it was quite a time. And we made some rather good contacts through that, and people were quite taken by the Bible studies. As you may remember, some of you know, I took along a sample Bible study and scripture memory of the nations of the world where we have these materials and had them in kind of a red notebook. So I'd stood there about halfway through. I'd say, by the way, these are materials that we have, and here's a little sheet you can get if you'd like to see some of these materials. And I'd throw that thing in the corner and put my sheet down here. Well, you know how a colorful notebook with all these colorful materials, you know, people get excited. And when it was over, rather than go out the door, they just all come this way and they take our... So we have hundreds of these things out now around the world where people can get in contact with navigators in various parts to get these materials. But suffice it to say, God just really blessed that time far more than I had imagined that He would. From there we went to England, had a training program led by Gordy Nordstrom, who I feel is doing a really excellent job in England. He's in Scotland right now. I think he's recruited some of the finest young leadership that I see over there. And I saw something happen in England that became a pattern for the trip. At each of the training programs, we spoke at England, Sweden, and Finland for the navigators. Somewhere early in the game, Virginia would speak. And then she would vanish, you know, just out of sight. I would never see her again because these girls would listen to what she had to say and realize they had a gold mine here, you know. Here was a gold mine sitting right here in our middle of us. So they'd take her and whisk her off, and I'd never see her till the thing ended, you know. Then we'd get on the plane together and, hi, how are you? What you been doing, you know? And it was really beautiful the way that God used Virginia. The first night in England, some girl came up and said, can I get some time with you? And so Virginia said yes, so they went over and sat in the library. So I said, well, how about 45 minutes? We'll head back to where we're staying. She said, okay. So 45 minutes went by, and I know Virginia, so an hour. And so finally I opened the library door, you know, going to say, shall we go? And here was this girl crying on Virginia's shoulder, you know, just weeping her heart out. And Virginia looked over at me and went, you know. But God used Virginia in a beautiful way among the staff wives and the girls workers and the confreries and whoever that could get to her. Why, they really took her time, and it was really exciting for me to see. We left England after a great time there for Sweden. We arrived 29 hours late on our flight from a non-stop flight from London to Stockholm, in that we ran into a strike at the airport, Heathrow Airport in London. And we didn't know there was a strike, and so, of course, we put our bags in and everything else. And just as we got to passport control, they said, you know, nobody's going anywhere. So there we sat. And this was the peak holiday weekend. So people coming in by the hundreds, you know, just hundreds of people, and nobody going out. So, that, you know, and the people are bringing in folding chairs and plastic chairs and all kinds of benches, and the place has just turned into a madhouse. But we finally did get out and arrived 29 hours later and met by Jan Pearson in Sweden. Had a general conference. Dave Kraft ran the conference. Jan Pearson interpreted us, and this was really a great time. And that's really a wonderful gang up there in Sweden. We met some tremendous people. And there's one guy out there that looks like Danny Kaye, and he was the song leader. And then I would just sit there and howl, you know, because he was so neat. Everything he did was just perfect. But the time in Sweden went very, very well. Jan Pearson is doing, a fine job in heading that work. Dave Kraft is one of those Americans who hit the ground running and has not skipped, you know, missed a beat the whole time. They've taken to him. He's taken hold, learned the language, doing a fine job. So that was a good time. Then Virginia went to Germany, and I went to Expo 74 from Sweden. So I waved goodbye to Virginia, and she got on the airplane, and I sat for about an hour and then headed for Expo, and I went the Trans-Siberian route, which means you go to Copenhagen, then go to Moscow, and then across Siberia to Tokyo. And that took about 10 hours. And when I arrived in Seoul and in Tokyo, I thought, well, what I'll do is call and confirm my flight and, you know, get that all set up. So I called, and, oh, yes, Mr. Imes, right, you're on the flight to Seoul. Yes, we have you ready to go. You know, no problem. I said, they said, by the way, the one problem is that you're on standby coming from Seoul to Tokyo. Right. Now, if I don't make that plane, you see, Virginia goes from Frankfurt to Moscow and is in the middle of Russia wondering where on earth is Leroy. And so I had to make that plane. It was one of those things I really felt that I had to do. So I began to call other airlines. And the only word I got was, it is impossible, Mr. Imes. It is impossible. Then I'd go to the desk. I'd say, look, I got to make that. It is impossible. Everything was booked. You know, they had a thing going there, Expo 74. They moved a city into a city, and, you know, lots of people. Well, okay. So now then, do you go to Seoul just sort of saying, well, God will lead? Or do you use your head and stay in Tokyo and head back knowing that I better be there when Virginia gets there? You know, what do you do? So there I sat. And I didn't know what to do. And those of you that have experienced jet lag know how you are when you've just gone from Europe to the Orient, which I'd never done before, but I was completely turned around. Well, of course, at night I couldn't sleep. Well, the day everything was going on, I didn't sleep. So here I am now. I hadn't slept for a couple days, and I was very discouraged, tremendously discouraged. I felt weak, just like I couldn't raise my arms, and I was so homesick, you wouldn't believe it, just homesick beyond belief. And discouragement, I mean, you know, here I am, what do I do? And there's not another navigator in town. Everybody in Japan is on holiday. Everybody, you know. So, what do I do? Well, I didn't know what to do. And I'm laying there in the middle of the night, discouraged and weak and homesick. Feel I've kind of been, alone. And then God brought a verse to mind. One I'd memorized, I think about, 15 or 20 out of the TMS. I memorized Joshua 1:9 about 25 years ago. Haven't I commanded thee, be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. So I was discouraged. Be strong and of a good courage. I was weak. Be strong and of a good courage. I felt I was all alone. The Lord thy God is with thee, whithersoever thou goest. Well, on the strength of that verse, and just a sense of obligation, like I gotta go. I mean, I can't come all the way from Copenhagen to Tokyo and then not go to the thing that I've come to do. I flew to Seoul. And I arrived, and Larry Lee was there to meet me. And I told him, now look, I got to get a flight back. I've got to find a seat on an airplane. So we stopped at the JAL office on the way to the hotel. And they had a seat. I'll take it, you know. Great. So they signed me up for that seat. Beautiful. I had a confirmed. A day later, I said, now Larry, now call and confirm that reservation to make sure that I got that seat. I'm calling on the behalf of Mr. Imes. Mr. Imes, we don't have him. No, there's no such name. No, there's no confirmation. No, we don't have any ticket. No, we don't have that. I'm sorry. You know, it is impossible. Right. So here we are. You know, I mean, everybody that I knew, I got praying, dear God, get a seat on that airplane. Well, the day before I left, I was ready to leave, Madam Park was shot. You may remember reading that in the newspapers. I was in King Kaufman's office at the time. King Kaufman is the man that's in charge of the 8th Army deal there in Seoul. And, of course, is any of our people involved? No. What's happened? Madam Park's been shot in the foot. Another girl has been hit and killed. Madam Park has actually been shot in the head, but the early reports, this was only 10 minutes after it happened, so kind of things are flying around. And things got a little tense in Seoul at this time because the Koreans are noted for their run a tight ship, you know, and they didn't want things to get out of hand. And here's a whole new city in their city now. A lot of strangers, you know, foreigners, and things are a little touchy. Well, the next day I left on the airplane. Fifteen people walked on the airplane because no Korean or no Japanese was allowed to leave the country. Not one. And if you can imagine a screaming mass of people down here in this airport with confirmed reservations, the airplane sitting there, and you can't get on it. We've got to get on it, you know, and it was the irresistible force meeting the immovable objects, and the Koreans won, and nobody got on the airplane except a few Americans like myself, you know. So here we prayed, dear God, make an empty seat. Well, Larry Lee and I were sitting there, you know. And as far as you can see, there's not anybody on this plane. There was not one soul on this airplane in our whole compartment. And you know, and I prayed, you know, quietly with Larry. And God, you know, help us to have a seat somewhere where we're not suffocated by smoke. Because JAL is noted for, there wasn't another person not only smoking, there wasn't anybody on the airplane, you know. So we looked around, you know, and there is this. This is what I call an answer to prayer. You know? Beautiful. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Expo. Expo 74. They were planning on about 300,000 people, as you know. And depending on whose count you take, either 300,000, 600,000, or 1,000,003, or 1,000,006 were there. Now, it's a little discrepancy, you know. There's a certain range there, but, you know, depending on whose figures you got. But just take 300,000. You got them living in an open field, and they're out there in tents, and it's the monsoon season, right? How do you feed them? What do you do? Well, what you do, three meals a day, how do you feed them? Well, you get 800 tons of rice is your first move. 800 tons of rice, and you get 30 huge made for this particular occasion, rice boilers. 30 of them. The biggest, giantest piece of gear you've ever seen in your life. And then you start cooking 800 tons of rice. And you feed that along with 1.8 million loaves of bread. And here is this mass, this sea of humanity out here. And then you have each person bring a sheet and a blanket. And they sleep on the floor, or go to these tents, or go to homes or so on, you know. 50,000, you know, sleeping in tents. And then you got another problem. You got five languages. Now this is an open field. There's no, you know, like sitting down and putting on earphones like in here. This is an open field. And people just showing up, you know, buses, trains, walking, bicycles, hordes of people. How do you communicate with five languages in an open field with 300,000, 600,000, 1.3 million or 1.6 million people sitting out in front of you. How do you do that? Well, you get translators, of course. Right. Then what do? All shout in unison? Do you string 1.8 or 1.6 million wires out and everybody put a wire in there? No, you couldn't do that. What do? Let me show you what they did. You give everybody a radio. Everybody gets a radio. And they take out their little radio and they put up the thing and they turn it on. And what comes on is not music, but your interpreter's voice. And they give you a little earplug here, so you sit there with a thing in your ear and listen to the meeting. Tremendous idea. Especially when the radio is marked Expo 74, Seoul, Korea. What an idea. You see, there's always a way to do it. There is always a way to do it. It's your attitude toward the problem is all that matters. If you say to yourself, it can't be done, right? Right. Exactly. It cannot be done. But if you tell yourself, oh, there's a way to do that, there's a way. Even if it means giving everybody that comes a radio. There's always a way to do it. All that matters is our attitudes to the problem as we approach it. That's the only thing that matters. I was so challenged by these guys, Camps Crusade for Christ, they challenge me to pieces. I really get excited when I'm with that gang. And here again, they just showed us how to do it. How do you, world, do you communicate? The night before the opening night, we're sitting there. Now, nothing started. Just have a little prayer meeting, right? You know how when you have a conference, you have a prayer meeting before. Somebody came running in the hotel. There's 300,000 people praying out there. And somebody else came running by. There's 600,000 people praying out there. No, there's 1.3 million people praying out there, And the conference hadn't started yet. Well, beautiful. So the next morning I got up and went out to one of my speaking deals. I went there, to speak at this thing. And so I spoke on the word to the college crowd. And that went very, very well. I was really excited when I came back to that and from that and was all fired up. But my next assignment was to preach to the Korean pastors. Now, what on earth do you tell Korean pastors who pray all night, have their people pray all night, who are setting the pace, according to Billy Graham, for the whole rest of the world church to see? What do you tell a bunch of pastors, especially, a guy like myself, who hasn't done all that much? What do you tell people like this? Well, I really made that a matter of prayer. I bore down in prayer on that. And then I thought, I'll do what the letter originally said. I'll just talk to them about my thing that I presented at Luzon, namely how to follow up a new babe in Christ. Except rather than teach it, I'll preach it. Because I learned from my last trip in Korea that they like preaching. They don't like someone teaching, see. So I changed my little deal around to a preaching thing rather than a teaching thing. And I got there with this guy, this Korean, and we went at it. And I told him that my topic today was going to be how to help a new convert become a strong, mature disciple of Christ. Well, then this guy said that, and there was one young pastor sitting over here. I could see, he sat up, and his eyes, you ought to have to understand, they've been living in tents, sleeping, eating, 8 billion tons of rice, and the rain, all like this. So they're little, His eyes came open, he leaned forward, he listened very carefully, got out his notebook, and he wrote down everything I said from then on. I thought, here's my man, I found someone to preach to, And he was really fired up and excited. When the thing was over, we had a little chat. But that was my guy. I preached to this one pastor, and then we had quite a time. Well, then I had to leave shortly after that, the next day, to go to Moscow on Aeroflot, the Russian Airlines. And the Russian Airlines is a great airline. They're a very comfortable airlines. They left on time, and they arrived on time. And it was tremendous service. We got on the airplane, they served us juice. Then as soon as the juice was out of the way, they served us this chicken dinner. Chicken breasts, a nice big hunk of chicken breast with gravy and all the trimmings. Beautiful thing. Then they let us sleep for a while. Then they kind of got us all up. Took 10 hours, We got us all up and served us sandwiches, 7-Up, and ice cream. Now, when was the last time you had ice cream on an American flight? Sandwiches, 7-Up, and ice cream. Then when that was all settled, they brought around a big, huge steak dinner to round out the trip. And we arrived on time. And whenever I get a chance to take Aeroflot, I'm going to take it. You know, I like that airplane. Well, then I landed, and only to discover there's four airports in Moscow, and I'm to meet Virginia, right? And here I am. So I go to the customs man, and I say, when does this airplane get in? I don't know, ask him out there, you know, right. So I go out there, when's this airplane get in? It's not our department, ask him over there. So I went, and I got this giant runaround, which I discovered, by the way, is kind of the thing in Russia. People only get in their way. The people are just in the way. Like you go to breakfast, right? The objective is to move silverware and napkins and dishes. See, that's the objective. If you want a cup of coffee, here's how it is, you know. Coffee? Like it's the first time they've ever heard the word, you know. Especially at breakfast. Coffee! Or, you know, and I'd say, could I have some tea? Tea! They've never heard of tea. Especially, at, you know, never heard of tea at breakfast. It was a whole new world, see. And then they'd kind of... I mean, it's a real, Russia is still Russia, believe you me. It was a rare experience. So here I am getting this runaround. It was my introduction to the place. So finally I saw a couple guys playing chess. It looked like college students, kind of bearded, kind of westernized Russians. So I said, hey pal, do you speak English? Yeah. I said, I got a problem. So I explained my problem. I want to know where my wife is coming in. Oh yeah, I'll make a phone call. So he made a phone call. And the phone rang and rang and rang. Dialed again, three times. He says, they don't answer their phones, you know. I mean, that's it, see. Nobody answers their phones. No one's interested because, you know, you might have to get involved. Might have to help people or something. They don't answer their phones. And you could tell he was disgusted. And then suddenly I saw this guy running at me, you know, and it was this guy. He said, that's your flight. They've just called it. So Virginia arrived. Praise God, in the same airport. And we went through customs. Now, we went through customs... And you got to understand, I've been preaching in Sweden, England, Luzon, Korea. I had sermons, you know, a box, I mean, a whole briefcase full of sermons. Just tons of paper about taking the world for Christ, the lordship of Jesus Christ, how to make an impact on a nation for Christ, you know, all that stuff. Had that all in one place. Had this big black Bible, you know, with a bunch of other books and this other, you know. Now, what I didn't know, see, I went into Russia without ever asking anybody anything, which was stupid. But that, you know, I did. I didn't know who to ask anything, as a matter of fact. But what I discovered later from the Finns who go back and forth to Russia just with a passport, I mean, just present your passport and you're in, is that 3 weeks ago, a woman went in with a songbook, just a hymn book, right? A hymn book. They saw that hymn book and they practically fainted. They took that hymn book away from her. Then they took her and searched every part of her and all of her luggage, stripped all of her linings out of her clothing, took the linings out of her suitcases. I mean, they were nervous when they saw somebody coming in with a hymn book. Now, Virginia's got Bibles. She's got, you know, like we went through the thing and they said, do you have any books? And she says, yes, I have a book, The Knowledge of the Holy, here, you know. I have a book, you know. I didn't know about, you know, that you weren't supposed to do this. Made him so nervous, you know. So we get up there, and the guy in front of us, we're finally up where we can see what's going on, you know. So they take his billfold, and they took everything out of it, and then put their fingers in through every piece of thing. They made him unwrap everything in his suitcase, undo all of his T-shirts and shake them. They checked all the lining. They took his watch and took it apart. I mean, everything. And here I stand, see, with tons of this gear, you know. So we get up and we present our, you know, landing papers and everything. We give it to them. And so the girl says, do you have any books or magazines? And she says, yes, I have, you know, books and magazines. She starts taking them out. And you know what the woman did? She said, go. And we went in without opening up a suitcase, a briefcase, anything, nothing. Just walked through. Well, I don't know how you account for that, except that God just had us walk through, you know. Well, we went to the hotel, the same hotel that Lenin stayed in when he was plotting his revolution, by the way. And we had a great time. 3 days across the square from the Kremlin. And if you ever go there, we're at the corner of Karl Marx and Gorky, which is where we stayed there. And we had three great days. And God worked it out so that we had the same tour guide every day. You're not supposed to, but we did. And I asked Virginia if she would tell you just a little bit about this tour guide. And then I'll wrap this up, Bob. We'll be done, okay? You can just hold that if you'd like.
I can hold this. But my hand will be so nervous if I hold it, you'll see it. Well, it was really quite an experience to go into Russia. And my own heart didn't really know what to expect, but I knew that God was taking care of us. It was so evident on the trip. You just knew day by day that people were praying, that God was just undertaking. His grace was sufficient for the whole trip. But going into Russia was really quite an experience. And just the provision of this young girl to take us around and show us Moscow was another provision and an opening for the gospel. She was a lovely young Russian girl. She stood about 5'7", slender, dark hair and dark eyes, and quite unusual for what the usual girl that you saw on the street. She was, it seemed like something special, and it seemed like the Lord just sort of knit our hearts together from the very beginning. The reason she has a job as a tourist guide, she's learning English, so that in the future she can work with what she calls machines, but they're really computers. And she's going to translate the English from those into Russian. Well, the first day she took us around and showed us just some of the major sites in Moscow. And I might say that Moscow or Russia is completely different than what I anticipated. From pictures that you see and from news broadcasts and so on, you sort of have the impression it's almost like America in many aspects. But it really isn't. And the verse that the Lord brought to my mind as I walked down the streets was, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And you can see where God is left out of a nation, where the gospel doesn't have free course. This nation is in a state of decay. And this is really what impressed my heart, because it's really a great and glorious nation, but it's decaying. The people are decaying, and the country and Moscow is decaying. So there's such a great need there. But the way God opened the door for us just to have some time with this girl, Olga, was really quite an experience. That first day, she just showed us Moscow. And one of the places she showed us was a convent. Well, here again, it was just, you know, many areas it was decaying. But there was a church there, the Russian Orthodox Church. And we could hear singing from this church. And so Leroy and I asked, could we go inside this church? And she said, yes, you may go in, but I can't. So we went in, and most of the people there were older women. They had their kerchiefs tied around their heads. There were a few men, and there were tourists, but there were very few young people. There aren't any seats in this church. It's just a stone floor, and everybody was standing, and they were singing. And they were singing their prayers, being led by a priest. And this was quite moving, because you could tell deep within their hearts that there's a great hunger. Perhaps some of them did know the Lord, a good possibility that most of them didn't. But they were really crying out to God, and there were even those who were kneeling on the stone floor, singing their prayers, but they were singing from the bottom of their heart. Well, she could see that we were, we were interested in spiritual things. She wouldn't call it that, but she could see that. And she did ask a few questions. One question she asked Leroy, he went in as an educator, and she says, well, what do you teach? And Leroy said, well, I teach many things. And she didn't pursue that any further, so I praise God for that. right at that point, anyway. Well, the next day, no, further on in the day, we had asked her, do you know where the Baptist church is? There's a Russian Baptist church in downtown Moscow. And we asked her where it was, and she said, no, I don't know where it is. And so we said, well, if it's possible to work it in on the tour guide, we'd really like to see it. So she said, well, we'll try to find out where it is. We had a private driver that was driving us around. So it was the driver, Olga, and ourselves. So she asked the driver if he knew where it was, and he said no, he didn't either. But when she took us into another spot to see, the driver found out where the Baptist church was located. So he drove around and finally found it. And it was sort of like a big apartment building. It didn't look like a church. And she said, well, I'm not sure this is it, but I'll go in and ask if this is the church. So she went in and asked, and she came back out and she said, well, I'm really not sure that this is the church. But she said, these people are looking for an advent. And, of course, Leroy and I immediately knew what she meant. These people are looking for the second coming of Christ. And we knew immediately this is where the church was. Well, as I mentioned before, the country's in a state of decay and the people are in a state of decay. And the expression on the average Russian face is nothing. There's no glow to their eyes. You know, their face is very solemn. But when we walked in this church, there was a man there to greet Leroy. He says, "You're English," and he shook his hand, and his eyes were alive. And the church was packed. The whole church was packed. People were lining the aisles. All the little ante rooms were full of people. They had loudspeakers to carry the message. There was a courtyard here. People were standing out here. And the man took us up and asked two people to move from two seats in the balcony and ask us to sit down. And we stayed there for 10 minutes and just kind of watched the people as the sermon was being preached. And it was in Russian and we couldn't understand it, but you knew that people's hearts were being ministered to. That was really quite an experience. Well, we could only stay 10 minutes because our driver was there, and so we went back out and continued our tour. Well, the next day, Olga took us to the museum. It's inside of the Kremlin, and it has some rather spectacular things in it, a lot taken from the church and cathedrals there. And one of the things that was in the showcase was this big sort of brass plate-like affair, but on it was the story of Jesus Christ. It started from his birth and his childhood, and when he was anointed by the Spirit, and then his ministry, and then, of course, his time in the Garden of Gethsemane, his crucifixion, his resurrection, his ascension, and his coming again. Well, Leroy had an opportunity then to go through the whole thing and just explain this to Olga, which gave an opening for him to share the gospel without preaching the gospel, so to speak. And so she turned to us and she says, "You know your Bible." She said, "Do you read the Bible?" And we said, "Yes." And she says, "Do you pray?" And we said, "Yes." Well, then God just opened further door. Inside the Kremlin are four great cathedrals. They're not used. They're just for tourists to look at. But inside of these cathedrals, at the altar up here, are pictures, again, the story of Jesus Christ. So here again, you know, we could go through. Leroy went through again and just mentioned, well, this is when he did this, and this is when he did that. So once again, you know, just the opening to share the gospel with this dear, dear girl. Well, I could tell that she had a very tender heart. And when we were in the museum, there was a big blanket made out of parrot feathers. And she thought that was very cruel to have killed these parrots, to have put their feathers on this blanket. Well, the next day, she took us to some more sites to see. And once again, I could see the tender, tender heart of this young Russian girl. We went by a circus, and she says, well, this is where the circuses are held, and so on. And we ask her, well, do you like to go to the circus? And she said, well, no, not really. She says, I don't like the way the animals are trained because you have to beat them to train them. Well, once again, you know, it just showed me that this was a girl who had a very tender, sweet heart that needs Christ. Well, when the tour was over, oh, I might mention one thing. Maybe Leroy was going to mention this. I asked her all kinds of questions. I said, oh, do you have any boyfriends? What, you know, what's your future? And all these things that girls normally ask girls, you know. And so she was very free to tell me and to tell about her family. She has a brother that's a teacher, and he plays the piano and so on. So it seemed like the Lord just really knit our heart together with her. And so Leroy said, well, Olga, we'd like to send you a gift. She said, oh, no, you don't need to do anything like that. He said, oh, yes, I'd like to send you a cowboy hat. So we're going to try very hard to send a cowboy hat to Olga. And but when the whole thing was over, and this is only to the glory of God that she said this, but she shook our hands and she said, you know, she says, you're very nice people. Well, you know, that was strictly from the Lord, you know, opening the door and opening, allowing us to open our lives to her. But God gave me a great burden for Olga, and I've asked many people when we went into Finland, I asked the girls to start praying for Olga. And I'm asking many people down back here to pray for Olga, because God is not limited in as far as reaching Olga for Jesus Christ. A little bit of the seed has been sown, and if people start praying, I know that God will send further light. And when we get to glory, we're going to see Olga there. So if God lays it on your heart, I really appreciate your prayers for Olga. And I have a million other stories I could tell, but it was really a glorious trip. Thank you.
We can show you a picture of Olga when our pictures get developed, because as I took pictures, I'd make sure we got her in with Virginia. That time of witnessing to her was really special, because all along the way, you'd have a chance, you know, I'd say, oh, look at this picture. It'd be Jesus ascending into heaven. Let's count them. So it'd be 12 apostles. One too many, you know. And then I'd tell about Judas, how he defected and did this and did that, you know, and the garden and the crucifixion and on and on and on, you know. And then I say, know who these guys are? No, well, they're angels. They've come back to tell these apostles to get with it. They're supposed to go and preach the gospel to the whole world. So you're not standing here gazing to heaven, so I go through that whole routine. And then, you know, but Jesus is coming again, see, because that's what he's telling them. Jesus is coming. I mean, it was just all along the way. Quite a wonderful time. Okay, now on, and we got, you know, lots have happened, but I got to run along here. On the way out of Russia, it's the only place I know where we got to go through customs twice, in and out. Now, one of the things are things like this, see, that they didn't look at going in. But one of the things you've got to declare going out is you have absolutely nothing, I mean none, of these things, Russian rubles. You have none of these with you. You don't have any. You sign your name, your signed sworn statement, see? And then if you do, you have just broken the law. Well, these were laying in the bottom of Virginia's purse. Everything is in the bottom of Virginia's purse, you know? I'm going to invent a purse with a zipper on the bottom. That's where everything is, you know. But anyhow, these were, and no, we didn't know they were down there. So now, right, we got Bibles, sermons, spiritual books, and Russian rubles going out, okay? And here is this steely-eyed, you know, customs inspector, and the one that's going to go through everything and go through the metal detector, the little thing that says bing when you go through if you got stuff on you, right? Well, we got plunged into a tour group that are trying to get to Oslo, but they got to go to Helsinki, Copenhagen, and then Oslo. And they're kind of discouraged, and they're late, and so on. And there's 40 of them. So the first guy goes through. They announce our plane has arrived, so now the first one goes through. And the bell rings. So off with his coat. The bell rings. So off with everything. The bell rings. So off with everything. The bell rings. I mean, everything out of his pocket. And he's getting a kick out of this. Because, an American, because it's an evidence that their technology is goofed up. So all the rest of these 40 Americans are standing there, see? Because he's a great big fat guy. He's down to his t-shirt. It's obvious he's got nothing hidden anywhere, see? And he goes through and the bell rings. Bang, you know, bah, and he'd scream and the rest of them would laugh. Well, that went on and on and on. I mean, he went through that thing 50 times, you know. And the plane gets later and later and later and later and later. And this Russian is getting more uptight and more uptight because their technology is proving faulty in front of all these Americans. Now, if, you know, if human fat can ring a bell detector, that's one thing, but it can't. It takes metal, see? And here we stand, next in line, you know, with Russian rubles and... So finally, after I don't know how long, finally this inspector looks at the whole lot of us and just says, go! You know. And we all walked on, never opening our suitcase going in or out, never looking at anything going in or out. And if you'd like to see what a Russian ruble looks like, you may be probably the only people in America that look at them, because there they are, you know. And I suppose I should send them back or something. But anyhow, that was that. And we know we're totally unaware of this potential danger that's ours, see, because, you see, when you break a law in a foreign country, you've broken a law, and they take all that very seriously. You know, you've heard about these drug laws. Well, they crack down on lawbreakers, and this is a law. So, anyhow, we went through and unchecked. Let me just mention one thing about Finland. When we got to Finland and we told them these stories, those people who know the system said, that's a miracle. That's just nothing but a miracle. That cannot happen. And everything we tell them happened, they assure us that cannot happen, see? So the Lord really worked. Finland, by the way, is dominated by Russia. I don't know if you knew this or not. They're considered the little brother. Russia, the big brother. The joke is you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your relatives, and that's our big brother over there, you know. But the Russians do control the newspapers, radio, television. And our gang, by the way, the whole university has been turned over to our gang, having been told, you're the only ones that have any inroads into this place. We've tried it and failed. And all the other Christian movements there have just given up. And they say, we back you. You're the ones. So Tom Heat is doing a great job. And this Finnish bunch, we came home from Finland with them for 10 days at a training program on a little island out here, and went out by a little boat. There's no heat, no plumbing, very rustic. It reminds me exactly of Maranatha in the early days, you know. It's like going home, boy. It was a great time. And except one unique thing. In Maranatha, we'd organize a thing where we get up in those morning exercises. Well, these Finns, we get up and have morning exercises, run for 2 or 3 miles, then all go jump in the Baltic Sea. Kerslush! You'd hear that swimming in the Baltic Sea. Then come to breakfast, the girls be shaking a little bit, you know. I'd say, "You cold?" "Yeah, I'm a little cold, you know." Then at night, after their exercises and games and sports, then they'd go sauna and then all jump in the Baltic Sea. They got something about that Baltic Sea that I don't quite understand. They're a hardy bunch. And language in Finland is a very, very tough language. It comes from out east somewhere. It's not related to anything in Europe. It's very difficult to learn. And there's two official languages in Finland, Swedish and Finnish, both official languages. So the guy that interpreted for me, his first language is Swedish, but he interpreted English into Finnish. And I don't know how that strikes you, but, you know, people say, well, do the Finns really have it? You know, they really got it. Well, they know 2 and 3 and 4 languages. I know that much. And they jump in the Baltic Sea, you know. So. I was going to share 2 or 3 verses with you, but I think I'll quit because time is getting away from us. But I do just thank you very much for praying. It was really a marvelous time for us, far, far beyond anything that we thought of. I'll show you one thing that Russians really do well. They have little carvings. They have this little bear, and they carve him. This is a soccer bear. And I hear the Glen Eyrie bunch is going to have a soccer team, so that might be your mascot. You can call yourself the Glen Eyrie Bears or something. But this little Russian bear does everything. He helps the farmer cut trees. He helps the farmer fish. All he's in carvings. They also have a little weightlifting bear. And, of course, I got that for my little area. And he actually lifts the weight. Never misses. He always gets it right up there. But it was kind of fun to see the little bear, and we brought some souvenirs home. But anyhow, thank you very much for your prayers, and the Lord spoke to our hearts in many deep, deep ways and taught us a lot. And along the way, we were able to share some things I know that would be of encouragement to others. So let me just lead us in a brief word of prayer.